You're listening to Brick to the Future, the property investment show for everyday Australians. We cut through the white noise so you can minimise risk and make smart, informed investment decisions. If you're after tips and strategies while building a property portfolio that suits your lifestyle, you're in the right place.
If you could rewind the clock back 25 years and start from scratch, what would you do differently? That is the topic for today's conversation. I'm here with Open Corp Group CEO, Matt Lewison. Louis, how are you?
Good, thanks, Boz.
It's shocking to believe, given that we've known each other for 25 years and therefore you've been investing that long that we can actually answer this question, you and I. Still feel like we're 18 playing footy together. But I guess, you know, rewind the clock and go back to the start of your investing journey. What were some of the initial challenges or misconceptions that you had about investing? Come up with the key lessons that you learnt over that time?
To start with, I was fortunate because there was one thing that I had as an advantage to a lot of other people when I started investing, and that was a lack of fear. I was 18, so buying an investment property and taking on some debt to buy an investment property, it was almost make-believe. Like, I'd never had a credit card. I'd never owed owed money. And I'd read a lot of books about property investing. I'd been to a lot of things. And my dad was an investor. So I accepted that that was part of being an investor. And that didn't initially concern me. Now, obviously, over time, as you start to take on more debt, and people might say, wow, you owe that much money, that starts to play on your mind. And I think the biggest learnings when I look back over my journey was there were so many opportunities to have done it much better. That fear of debt slowly crept in on me. My dad was conservative. I've never borrowed more than 80% to buy a property. I've never paid lender's mortgage insurance.
How we got 25 years down the track, and I haven't paid. We're always learning, guys. That's why we're here.
I did learn about it, obviously. There's obviously that opportunity you have early on in your portfolio where you can push that leverage, and it's important to get that extra, the extra holding of property. So I was probably running at, I don't know, half pace compared to perhaps yourself if you were using LMI at that same time. So obviously, as your portfolio gets bigger and bigger, your propensity to borrow that much to buy another property becomes less. But so that slowed me down a little bit. And again, because of that conservatism that crept in around debt, and I was really acutely aware of where interest rates had gotten to in the 80s, that had profound impact on my dad in terms of his investing. To just provide some context, so he was building a property, and his bank came and said, "You've got to pay us back in 2 months," and it was a half finished property that he pretty much had to sell at a bargain basement price to be able to clear that debt. So that kind of, you know, that impacted us as a family in terms of the way we thought about debt. Dad had overcome that, but it meant that when interest rates were going up in the 2000s, leading up, not during the GFC, it was before the GFC, but Australia was going through an inflationary period between 2004 and 2008. Interest rates were initially creeping up slowly and then more rapidly, that I sold a property to ensure that I was managing my cash flow well, and didn't necessarily have a need, like didn't need to sell. If I looked at my equity position and my buffers, I could have continued to hold that property. But when I was paying 9.5% interest, I thought, well, it would be beneficial to clear some debt so that every month I'm not paying any more than I originally budgeted to contribute to holding my portfolio. Now, with the benefit of time, I look back and say, well, 6 months later, interest rates were on their way down. But even if it had taken 2 years, the worst case scenario probably would have been that I spent an extra $10,000 out of my own pocket to hold that property. But if I held that property, then today I would have well over $500,000 extra in equity. And so that was an expensive lesson to learn around that kind of, and again, it comes back to that conservatism towards debt or that fear of debt, which I didn't have at the start, but it crept in. And I think that's, I could imagine that's something that other people who get into the market as an investor later, that's one of the biggest challenges I see that they have to overcome is their attitude towards debt. And when I certainly still don't advocate for people to mortgage themselves to the eyeballs at a point where they can't manage their cash flow. Like I made sure that I could always, you know, have a good lifestyle while I was growing my portfolio. But yeah, getting well educated around that, having kind of a balance, not just listening to the people who, like I was hearing, let's call it 98% of the people I spoke to were very like anti-debt, and a very small number who turned out to be the most successful were happy and comfortable to have debt as long as they were able to manage that well. So I think that's kind of, again, that lesson to get the right people around you. I was fortunate in many ways in that regard, but I also had my fair, well over my fair share of dream crushers in the stable. How about yourself?
Yeah, I have no idea where this saying came from, but I read it early days and I've never forgotten it. It's like the two kids in the playground at school when one of the kids says to the other kid, you know, we're so poor that we owe the bank $2,000. And he says, oh, well, we're so rich that we owe the bank $2,000,000. And so I was kind of the direct opposite of you. I didn't have the positive influences or the investor parents, you know, like you had with your dad to kind of set you on the course. As a result, I guess I didn't have the majority viewpoint around debt and that being a limiting factor. I guess the things that I learned early days back in my early 20s, I was keen to get into the property market and so on. I bought what's now an ex-principal place of residence with a now very ex-girlfriend as my first property. And I was telling this story on the weekend, actually. I just remember we went on a holiday and, you know, I had a credit card. Another learning, I guess, had a credit card and I could never get it down below kind of $800. And it kind of seemed to be, by the time we paid the mortgage and, you know, groceries and your wife and stuff, I could never, despite how hard I tried, I could never kind of get it below that $800. And so, you know, when that relationship ended and we sold the property and luckily we held it for a period where Melbourne market had been really strong, we came out of it with a small profit, and I paid my small car loan out, and I was left with some cash and then got into investing. It was all around the cash flow. Yeah. I bought a property for around $250,000. I mean, my cash flow was really constrained, yet I could hold an investment that I bought for marginally above that with no impact on my lifestyle at all. So that kind of... you had the same kind of insights around cash flow, but from a positive perspective, and then because I got the timing right on that investment, I was able to add to my portfolio 2 years later, and because the rent had gone up on the first one, what I was budgeting on the first one, I could hold both, and so I was kind of got it hooked on the rent investing side of things, and that it's not the amount of debt that's the hard part or the consideration, it's what's the cash flow to cover that debt. Yeah. You know, you can have $10 million worth of debt, but if you bring in so much cash flow that it's not costing you anything out of your disposable income to service that, then yeah, that's a great outcome. So yeah, that was my kind of key lessons. One other one that springs to mind, I bought my first three properties in the state. And the second one had done really well in a short space of time. So I bought again in that market. And that was around 2007 in Brisbane. And that was when kind of Brisbane's part of that growth cycle was coming towards an end. So I'm definitely feel happy I bought that property based on where it's at today. But it did take longer to grow than the others where I got the market kind of timing right. So the lesson always, if you don't look kind of short term around where the growth's happening, stay objective and use the right, you know, property selection criteria to make sure that you're maximizing your chances of getting growth sooner rather than later, so you can continue to duplicate. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, what we kind of learned. And just while I was talking, it kind of feels like it was yesterday that we did this, and that was 15 to 20 years ago.
Yeah. If there was one other thing, and look, this is not a lesson from bad, like it's not something I've learned that I kind of in hindsight wish I knew then, but it's something that's been reinforced, is that it only ever gets harder. They never change the rules to make it easier to buy property or be an investor, and it's never going to get cheaper.
Yeah.
And so when I think back about that period of time, that early growth phase that kind of I had and that you went through as well when you started your journey, and I talk about the fact that I probably didn't push as hard as I could have, that was the best time for me to have ever done it. Sure, my income grew after that, and it probably from a cash flow perspective would have been easier, but from a ability to make money over the medium and long term, had I pushed a little bit harder early on, it certainly would have made a bigger difference. Like it has a compounding effect forever after. And again, I would say to anybody who is early on in the journey now or just thinking about getting started, don't assume that it's going to be easier in 5 or 10 years. It's only ever going to get more complex as more layers are thrown. It doesn't mean that it'll become less rewarding, because I make more money out of my property portfolio today than I did in the early years, because of the size of the property, the values don't need to go up as much for it to have a huge impact. But yeah, just make the most of the opportunities when they're there, and don't hold out thinking that there'll be a perfect or an easier time to do it.
Sounds like good advice for your younger self. I was the same. I remember I caught up with one of my mentors and said to me, well, look, I was looking at my fourth property was. And he said, oh, you know, I don't know if you need to be this aggressive type thing. I said, well, my cash flow is fine. Like, why wouldn't I?
Yeah.
You know, and that was right before. That was in the GFC. And so there was a lot of negatives around, which was great buying opportunities.
Yeah.
And Melbourne really kind of rebounded very quickly on the back of the, what do they call it? The new home building boost, like the additional first homeowners grant if you built, you know, caused a really rapid increase in price. So, yeah, I guess buy when you can. That's advice that still rings today. Are there any kind of specific asset classes or strategies, I guess, that you wish you'd paid more attention to earlier on in your team?
That saying I've told, this is one of my dad's favorites, was when he was driving down the street with one of his early mentors, and he said, oh, I see that house there. I could have bought that 5 years ago for a fraction of the price. And I said, oh, Steve, mate, in 5 years' time, you'll be saying the same thing about now. And it's absolutely run true. But coming back to what you're saying about buying the right market, not necessarily asset class. It took me and my family a long time to realize that buying interstate opened up a lot more opportunities. Certainly there was more risks if we were uninformed when we did it, relative to buying where, you know, in our local area that we knew inside out. But once we had a system for overcoming that risk and identifying the right properties, it opened up more growth potentials because that market could be going up while a different one, the one we were initially in, was stagnant. I wasn't as familiar with the Perth market as I should have been early on, like in the 2000s. And it went through a couple of periods where, you know, it saw 100% growth in just a couple of years, which is crazy compared to the East Coast. Like the bigger cities tend to not have such sharp increases in price, but they're a bit more consistent and steady over time, whereas Perth can go up and stagnate for a while. But in those windows of time where it goes up, the equity you can create, the cash flow that those properties produce is awesome. So it took a long time to I guess, realize the benefits of that diversification in different states. Different asset classes. Look, I've invested in just about every type of residential property. I've owned commercial property, done development. I continue to come back to residential property. And maybe that will change at a point in the future when I decide that my needs have changed, but obviously I'm growing wealth and I know no better asset class than residential property to safely and consistently grow equity, which opens the doors later on. And if, as a we've previously talked about exit strategies or transitioning to retirement, and opens the doors to own different types of assets that perhaps have higher income but lower capital growth, depending on what the needs are. The lessons I learned from the various different asset classes or different types of residential property investment, whether that's block splitters, duplexes, development, co-living, I could name a bunch more, renovating, the reward for effort diminishes. There's certainly some wins financially from some of those, but the stress, anxiety, effort, focus required to ensure success, I over time realized that, again, a consistent approach to residential property with a low risk strategy, using the one, you know, the 10 to 21%ers that you can do that don't actually require a lot of effort, but just require a good plan, produce far and above the best return on effort and risk of any investment I've made.
Yeah. It's I actually kind of forgotten about this until you talk a little bit, when we moved to a new area like around 2010, our pre-kids, you know, we'd go for a walk on the weekend, and it kind of felt like that, you know, every property was up for sale, and these are, you know, 17-meter frontage blocks and standard stuff, and they're all being sold, and you know, being said to, she goes, you know, why are all these selling and why are they all passing in? And the very kind of back of the envelope quick numbers in my head while we were walking, I'm like, well, based on what they want plus the stamp duty plus the bill cost to do a splitter, you're effectively taking $1.6 million worth of risk for maybe $80,000 to $100,000 in upside if you get everything right. And all that. That's not a great risk return, you know, trade off. And so, hence why they kind of weren't, yeah, the builders and the developers weren't as active with what they had been previously. The returns just weren't there. And I haven't had the same breadth of experience across different asset classes that you have. That's why I've got a really good question for you. But the thing I come back to is, you know, think about the way you drive to work every day or how you get to work every day. You don't take a different way, just a different day. You don't try with it to that. You won't be able to way to get it. And you just, whether it's repeat, and that's really not boring, but it's super effective. And that's the best way for your investment to be. You know? It's not about being sexy. It's about getting, okay, if you're going to get emotional about something, get emotional about the result. And then, yeah, to follow the proven method.
I'd much rather use my spare time now enjoying a good lifestyle than trying to work out how to solve problems on an investment. And look, to come back to your point in development, particularly small scale development, and I'll exclude large scale development. It's a completely different ballgame, and most people, it's inaccessible almost unless you're a corporate these days. But for small scale development, while there was periods of time where the planning schemes were changing around Australia and development and backyard development and that sort of thing wasn't as well known, there was absolutely a period where there was excess profits to be made. What I've seen mostly in the last 10 to 15 years is really small scale developments. I'm talking buying a house, splitting it in two. Most of the benefit comes down to time. That unless you know somebody and you've got an inside edge advantage over the rest of the market, most of the profits that people make, like you buy a block, you split it in two, like you said, if you're doing 1.6 million of risk, and maybe they end up making 300, not 100,000. But the extra 200,000 comes down to the market because it took them 2.5 years to 3 years to do the development. It wasn't the value they've added from planning. It was the value that the market added. And if they just went and bought two $800,000 houses, they would have probably made the same money with a hell of a lot less risk and focus and uncertainty. Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of one of the things I often come back to when people tell me, I think I really want to be a developer, and they're kind of starting from very low in terms of the knowledge base and relationships they need to be able to perhaps do a little bit better than the market. And I try to run the numbers for them to show them side by side. And if there is so much extra profit in just from taking something from A to B and like knocking something down and putting two up, and it was easy, then the price of the first thing would go up until there was no excess profit anymore. And you would just be making the market return. So yeah. Anyway, sorry to digress.
It's a lot of people would say that, and you use the word volatile, a lot of amateur investors might say that the markets are unpredictable. We say that there's a formula to understand that. But I guess knowing what you know now, what advice do you have maybe for people starting out to be able to navigate periods of significant market volatility?
All right. And when you say navigate, do you mean they own property? And like, how do you think about from a mindset perspective?
How do you buy right? How do you deal with it? How do you block out the white noise?
Yeah. Look, over time, through experience, through better models, through better access to information, we've become better at identifying. Like, and there's a feeling I have now where it's like there's periods of time where you go, I am absolutely certain of what's going to happen. I would say the COVID lockdowns being one of those periods where, you know, we wrote a book saying this is what's going to happen. Like, we're that certain. We published it because we said, well, it's, you know, make sure that there's a record of this, because I don't, you know, it's easy to say in hindsight that you said something was going to happen, but like, unless there's proof, like, you know, anybody can do it. So,
check it out, guys. Investing in the new normal. May as well give it a plug.
I mean, it's got some of the process we went through to understanding what was going to happen. And while the time might have changed, there's always those rules that we followed kind of consistent. So, for somebody starting out, I think there's false confidence that you can have where you're not necessarily that well informed, but you hear something and you have that you don't know enough to know to doubt what you're hearing. And that's positive and negative. Like, you can hear negative things. People are absolutely certain the market was going to crash a year and a half ago. And like, some markets prices didn't go down. Certainly in the different parts of each market, prices kept going up in the lower quartile, for instance, because of that affordability constraint and the lack of housing and the undersupply that was getting worse and worse as time went on. So I think, again, if I try to break that down, it's doubt what you hear from uninformed sources and verify what you hear from informed sources. Look for the, like, you know, you need proof. And while I can say that we do have a feeling of certainty at different times about different markets, you actually, I think, will very rarely, I believe, hear from me or anybody in our team saying, well, we guarantee this will be what the market does. Because there's always that component of risk. And if there wasn't a component, even a small one, then the returns would be far, far less. So our goal is to minimize that risk. And when I talk about that small degree of risk, I say part of it is I don't know what's going to happen at some other far-flung part of the world next year. So I can't say with guaranteed certainty that something might not happen that does affect the outcome. But I can say with a very high degree of confidence that unless something crazy happens at some far-flung part of the world, or perhaps even a little bit closer, that I'm pretty confident of what the outcome is going to be in this area and this type of property. And again, that can only come with experience, with depth of knowledge, with resources at your disposal. So I think if, again, when we started, there was small amounts of information and people who were sharing that information, but largely it required for us a leap of faith, and I think there's a lot less leap of faith now. The biggest leap is to overcome the voices that you're hearing from well-meaning friends and colleagues telling you their two cents to influence you, rather than going to the experts who have got the knowledge and the resources and systems to be able to provide you with guidance. And I really wish that I didn't have to, you know, I'm glad that I've got it now to share with others, but I wish that I didn't have to go through the thousands and thousands of hours of learning and growth all on my own time and on my own dime to get to a point where I could have that confidence without investing.
Awesome. Really quick one to finish. So what do you think your life would look like today if you had invested properly?
Wow. I would be a much sadder person. A lot less choice. I live in a different state and can travel for work whenever I want. I get to go overseas. I get to help people. And I think I would certainly be feeling a lot more constrained in my life. How about yourself?
I'd probably be stressing a lot about private school fees, maybe not even have the choice around where the kids went to school. Couldn't see myself living in our dream home like we are now. And being able to help those around us is a really satisfying feeling. That every day gives me a reminder on the positive things that we 20 years ago and continue to do today with our clients. So great episode today, Matt, on winding back the clock and what 25 years of insight has taught us. So thanks for joining us as always.
Thanks, boss.